Well, tonight's meeting is a one-off meeting. It's not part of a series. And I thought that this evening, rather than engaging in a Bible study, which is, of course, what we ordinarily do on Wednesday nights, this evening instead we would consider a question. And the question that I want us to consider is this: is Christianity true? Is Christianity true? Now, I suppose that as Christians, we don't usually speak very favorably of Richard Dawkins and Steve Jones and Christopher Hitchens and these other various guys who in recent years have found a niche in the market for a certain brand of popular atheism. This new atheism is characterized by passion and accessibility and relentless self-publicity across a wide range of media. And few of us then have been able to miss it, I'm sure. Most of us will have come into contact with it in some way or other. And as I say then, as Christians, we're not used to thinking of it very favorably. We have reacted very disapprovingly, and that, of course, with very good reason. But in one sense, at least, I think we ought actually to be grateful for these guys. And it's this, that they do at least take seriously this question that we're considering tonight. The question, is Christianity true? This question is taken seriously by these people that I'm talking about. You see, if you'd asked that question 20 years ago, in educated circles at least, people would have looked at you blankly. Is Christianity true? What do you mean? Is it true? Christianity is a religion. It's true for those who believe it. It's true for Christians in the same way that Islam is true for Muslims and Hinduism is true for Hindus and Buddhism is true for Buddhists. And that's great. That's what religion's all about. But you can't ask in an absolute sense, is Christianity true? If a scientist comes up with a theory or if a mathematician comes up with an equation, then you can ask of that theory or that equation, is it true? But not of a religion, not of Christianity. It's just a fundamentally inappropriate question. It's missing the whole point of what it's all about. That's the kind of response that you'd have got, certainly, as I say, in educated circles around 20 years ago. But Richard Dawkins and co, you see, they understand that that's nonsense. They understand that it is a highly appropriate question to ask, is Christianity true? And they understand that this is exactly the same question that you should ask of a scientific theory or a mathematical equation. You should ask of Christianity. And what's more, they even understand that if the answer to that question, is Christianity true, is no, then Christianity is a monstrous evil. There's no point in continuing with it. It should be jettisoned right away. They understand that, and that's good. It's good that they understand that. It's good that they're treating Christianity at that level, asking, is it objectively true? In the objective realm, the realm of facts and figures, the realm of the real world, is Christianity true? It's a vitally important thing to do. But if, of course, we agree with Richard Dawkins in the importance of the question, we hopefully disagree with him in the answer to the question. Because, of course, the answer that he and his colleagues come up with is no, Christianity is not true, and therefore it should, as I say, be jettisoned, and it should be thrown out, and it should be eradicated. It should be treated as a monstrosity, as something that is evil and perverse and wicked. We, on the other hand, I hope, come to the opposite answer, that no, Christianity is in fact true. And I want to then just consider for a few minutes this evening why we should come to that answer, why we should come to the inference, the conclusion that Christianity is true. Now, there's obviously tons of material that we could come up with in this connection, and this could be the basis of a whole series or several series rather than just one meeting this evening. And I'm going to be therefore very selective. I'm just going to talk about probably three areas, possibly four, depending on how we do, but probably three areas, I think. They're not necessarily the three areas that you would have chosen to talk about, but they're three areas in which I find a compelling evidence for the truth of Christianity. First area, then, the Bible. The Bible. Now, again, we could spend weeks just talking about the Bible, and we could go into manuscripts and archaeological discoveries and all that kind of stuff. But it's not any of that that I actually want to talk about. There's just one thing I want to bring out, and perhaps it reflects, I suppose, my own background in literature. And the point that I want to bring out is to do with the Bible's unity and its coherence. The fact that the Bible is one book, one story, from beginning to end, from Genesis to Revelation. Now, in and of itself, of course, there's nothing remarkable in that, is there? There's plenty of books that just tell one story from beginning to end. And there's plenty of books that do that very cleverly, that do it very expertly. Plenty of books where in the later section of the book you will have themes from earlier on being taken up and cleverly reworked and reintegrated and redeveloped. And you have all kinds of clever literary techniques that you come across in all kinds of books which you will have read and that I will have read as well. So in and of itself, there's nothing remarkable about the unity and the coherence of the Bible. But of course, there's one monumental difference, isn't there, with the Bible? You see, if you take a book by Ian McEwan, say, to use one modern writer whose literary technique is second to none, if you take him for an example, when he writes a book, for a start, he writes it all himself, doesn't he? And for another thing, he writes it over a few months, at the most over a few years. But then you go back to the Bible and think about the Bible. And the Bible has been written by numerous different authors. Numerous different authors living in completely different historical epochs, embedded in completely different cultures, using indeed completely different languages at times. Now, if the Bible therefore were merely a human project, if it was simply a human composition, that just wouldn't work, would it? Because you'd have all these writers, and because, as I say, they're living in different epochs altogether, different periods of history, and in different cultures, and using different languages, they would be thinking in all kinds of different ways. Their basic assumptions about the world will be completely different. They'd be looking at the world through completely different spectacles. And any book, then, that was composed by all these different people, started all those centuries ago, then continued a bit later on, and then finished centuries later, it just wouldn't flow. It would be unnatural, it would be crass, and it would be utterly unenjoyable. It would be wooden, it would be horrible, it would be a rubbish piece of literature. And yet you read the Bible, and it is so unified, and it is so coherent. From Genesis to Revelation, it is a single storyline, from creation to new creation, centering upon the crucified Jesus. And at so many levels, you could explore just the beautiful coherence of it, the way in which covenant succeeds covenant, the way in which the promises of the Messiah narrow down as you go throughout the Old Testament. There's so many levels. There's a unity and there's a coherence, which, as I say, if it were a merely human book, a merely human project, would be impossible over that period of time and with all those different contributors. Just to zoom in on one particular theme, the theme that we touched upon on Sunday night, the theme of God's nature, God's being as a triune God, the fact that God is triune, he is Father, Son, and Spirit. Now we would say, wouldn't we, that you see hints of that in the Old Testament. So in, for instance, the us references, we saw one in Genesis 1, didn't we, the other week. Let us make man. You have it again in Isaiah 6. Whom shall we send? Or then again in the fact that the word for God in the Old Testament, the Hebrew word Elohim, it's a plural word. We always translate it God, singular, and that's right that we should, but it's actually a plural word. It's literally gods in the Old Testament. And that, again, is another thing that we would say is a little hint. Or those angel of the Lord passages where you have that mysterious figure, the angel of the Lord, who in a single passage will both speak as though he is God, and yet also refer to God as someone else. And it's that mysterious nature. And again, we would say that's a hint that God is triune. Or a passage like Psalm 110, verse 1, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand. And again, we would say that's a hint. Well, if then the Bible is a merely human book, how do you explain those hints? Do we say that the explanation is this, that those Old Testament writers, they dropped in those hints deliberately, intending all along that centuries later the New Testament writers would develop them into a doctrine of the Trinity? Well, that's wishful thinking, is it not? Have you ever played that game where you sit in a circle and someone says a word, and then the next person says a word, and the next person says a word, and you're supposed to kind of make up a story? And it's a really frustrating game because you say a word hoping that the next person is going to take it in a certain direction that you've planned, and then they don't. They take it in a completely different direction. And that's what would have happened here, isn't it? There's no way just by coincidence that the New Testament writers would have picked up on those hints and developed it into the doctrine of the Trinity. Or there again, do we say that it is just a total coincidence and the New Testament writers weren't basing it on those hints at all, they just came up with the doctrine of the Trinity by themselves? Well, in that case, why did the Old Testament writers write so carelessly and loosely in the first place? Why did they use the word us? Why did they use the word Elohim, a plural for God? Now, you could explain perhaps one of those things, that it was a mistake, but all of them. And these are fiercely monotheistic writers. The writer of Genesis 1, as we saw, is a fiercely monotheistic writer, and yet he still uses the word us. And so I think that just by honing in on that one example, you can see that it doesn't work if the Bible is a merely human composition. And I'm saying then that this theme of the unity and the coherence of the Bible, it seems to me, as someone who has read a fair bit of literature, it seems to me that that is a compelling piece of evidence for the supernatural origin of this book and therefore of Christianity. Well, let's move on from the Bible. And secondly, let's think about the Gospels. Because I suppose that in a very particular way, Christianity stands or falls with the Gospels, doesn't it? We've said that the entire storyline of the Bible is it revolves around Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ, his person and work, is the fulcrum on which the whole thing turns. Well, of course, while the whole Bible is about Jesus, it's the Gospels that narrate his life and his ministry. Other parts of the Bible anticipate Jesus. Other parts of the Bible explain Jesus. It's the Gospels that narrate Jesus to us. And so, as I say, in a very particular way, Christianity stands or falls with the Gospels. And I have to say that I can never read the Gospels without being impressed by the sheer credibility of them. I can always understand why it was that J. Gresham Machen, when he was there in Germany, being exposed to liberal, critical, unbelieving scholarship that was attacking the supernatural elements in the Gospels, J. Gresham Machen would always go home after lectures and he would just sit on his bed and read Mark's Gospel in a single sitting. And he said it never failed to restore and recover his confidence in the genuineness and authenticity of the Gospels. And I can understand that because you can't read it, or I can't read it, without being impressed by that. And sometimes I try and read it with a skeptical hat on. Sometimes I try and read Matthew or Mark or Luke or John, through a kind of skeptical pair of spectacles. And I try to look for hints of embellishments in these Gospels. I try to look for indications that the supernatural phenomena and the miracles that are so abundant there were kind of inserted into the story. That you have a loose historical basis. Jesus did go those places and he did say some of those things, but then all this supernatural stuff was kind of written in on top of that. I tried to look for indications of that. Indications, in other words, that these, here was Jesus' friends and disciples and associates. And Jesus, they'd lived with Jesus. They'd heard his teaching and so on. And He was an inspiring rabbi. He was a brilliant charismatic figure. He was a brilliant people person, all the rest of it. And so after he died, when they wrote down the account, they wanted to communicate that, but a bit more. And so they embellished it. They wanted people to think that he was actually a supernatural person, that he was a heavenly person, that there was something divine about him. And so they embellished things and they brought in miracles and supernatural stuff that wasn't really there in the first place. So I tried to look for indications of that. But it just seems to me utterly improbable. And I say that for two or three reasons. For one thing, if then the writers have been embellishing things, you'd have thought they'd have made a better job of it. You see, if their goal was to take the life of this fairly remarkable rabbi, Jesus, and their goal was to make out that he was actually more than just a fairly remarkable rabbi, he was a supernatural person, he was divine, then, as I say, you'd have thought they'd have done a better job. Which miracles would you have thought they'd have really emphasized? Well, for one thing, the virgin birth, you'd have thought, wouldn't you? Because, I mean, that was utterly unique. No one's ever had a virgin birth. And so you'd have thought that they'd have really gone for that one. If they were trying to persuade people that Jesus was someone supernatural and they were prepared to embellish things, they'd have embellished that and they would have gone to town with it more. They would have included it on every page, reminding us Jesus was born of a virgin. And yet it's just referred to in passing, isn't it? You have it only in Matthew and in Luke and only where the account itself is at the beginning of the gospel. You don't have it referred to again. And then even more so, I suppose, you'd have thought they would emphasize the resurrection. If they were trying to embellish things, if the resurrection was something that they put in to convince us that Jesus was a supernatural person when he wasn't really, you'd have thought they would go to town on it more. Because you think of the proportions between the record of Jesus' sufferings and Jesus' resurrection. There's a lot more on his sufferings than there is on his resurrection, isn't there? The sufferings occupy so much. The resurrection, just a chapter at the end. And even then, the resurrection itself, if they were making this up, they'd have done a better job of it. For instance, why, in the passage that we read earlier, why were women the main witnesses to this thing? You wouldn't make that up. If you were making up this resurrection, you'd have made Peter and John the witnesses, wouldn't you? You'd have made men who had authority about them. You'd have made them the main witnesses, not some women. That just didn't help their cause. Why would they have done that? Well, there again, you have that astonishing verse. It's verse 17, where we read, when they saw him, so this is just before his ascension, when they saw him, they worshipped him, but we read, some doubted. I love that verse. It's, I suppose, a grim detail in itself, but it never fails to encourage me that this, we have an authentic text here. The writer telling us some doubted. If he's making this up, you don't include details like that. It's completely contrary, presumably, to his purpose. And so, as I say, you would have thought that if the writers were embellishing here, if they were taking the true story of Jesus and adding loads of supernatural stuff, like a virgin birth and a resurrection, lots of miracles, they'd have done a better job of it. Then again, you'd have thought, wouldn't you, that they would have sorted out the apparent inconsistencies. Because there are apparent inconsistencies, aren't there? Little details in the gospel accounts. Now, I think that you can explain those when you study them in detail. But as I say, at an apparent level, there do seem to be inconsistencies in little details of the accounts. And you'd have thought then that if these writers saw themselves as having license to tamper with the records, they would have sorted those out as a priority. They'd have said to each other, hang on a minute, we better get these straight. We better all be coming from the same direction. We better be saying exactly the same thing in every single passage where we've written on the same event. And yet, that doesn't happen. And again, then, that seems to me very credible. It seems to me that we are dealing with eyewitness accounts here, because eyewitnesses would report things slightly differently. If you and I watched an accident happen outside, you would report it to in a slightly different way than I would report it. Your emphases would be different from mine. And they might even appear, at face value, to be inconsistencies. Well, then again, you would have thought that if they saw themselves as having the license to tamper with these records, that they would have presented themselves in a bit of a better light, wouldn't you? Because it's fascinating how no one really comes out of these Gospels in a positive light except Jesus himself. And you'd have thought that, well, Peter, if he was involved in the embellishments, he'd have said, hang on a minute, while we're embellishing what happened with Jesus, while we're adding a few miracles and so on, can we also get rid of my denial, please? And can we also get rid of those times when I misunderstood Jesus so crassly? And those times when we all argued, it might be better to get rid of those as well, mightn't it? You'd have thought that they'd have sorted those kind of things out as well. But the fact that they're there, again, says to me that we don't have here a product of the early church, that we don't have something that's reflecting their agenda, but we have here a genuine eyewitness account of the life of Jesus. So the Bible points me in that direction. The Gospels do. But then a third thing, the resurrection, which we've already touched upon here in Matthew 28. But the sheer fact then of the resurrection, which again, of course, and perhaps supremely of all things, it's with this that Christianity stands or falls. And it seems to me that the resurrection is highly credible. There's the usual stuff, what happened to the body, that kind of thing. The eyewitnesses, the fact that Paul can talk in 1 Corinthians 15 about 500 people, and he can insist to those Corinthians that many of them are still living. In other words, go and check up for yourselves from the eyewitnesses. That seems pretty credible. But more than that, there are so many things that are inexplicable, aren't there, if the resurrection didn't happen. For instance, how do you explain the sheer energy of early Christianity if the resurrection didn't happen? Well, people say, well, martyrdoms can propel people and give people that kind of energy. When you see someone dying for a cause, then the followers are propelled with anger to really go and change the world as a result of that. But that's not how it happened, was it? Because when Jesus died on the cross, his followers weren't filled with anger, and they didn't immediately rush out and start preaching. They were depressed. They were their confidence seemed to be shattered. They were a pretty bedraggled and pathetic bunch, weren't they, in the hours following the crucifixion of Jesus. And yet something changed. Something happened that caused them to go from that to a state of confidence, a state of energy, a state of morale. And what could that have been? What changed the attitude of the disciples? What put the wind in their sails? Well, I suppose the best answer that people come up with is that they were the ones who stole the body. That's why no body ever emerged. The disciples stole it. Well, even supposing they did, does a dead corpse, does a dead body in their midst really answer to the case here? Does that really explain the energy of early Christianity? That sight of Jesus' corpse just drove them out to change the world? It doesn't psychologically make sense, does it? It's not watertight. That something massive must have happened to change the disciples from that depressed, beleaguered group to those people who went out and turned the Roman Empire upside down. And it seems to me that the only answer to that can be the resurrection. The resurrection can be the only thing that would have had a big enough impact upon them as to send them out, the changed people that they were. Well, then again, how do you explain Saul's conversion? The change that took place in Saul of Tarsus? How do you explain that apart from the resurrection? You say that he had a vision, but there's just no reason to suppose that he would have had a vision. He was at the very height of his persecuting activity, wasn't he? He was on the way to persecute more Christians. And there's no psychological explanation, therefore, of why on the road to Damascus he would have had a vision that wasn't really real. It was all in his mind. The only explanation, surely, for the radical change in Saul of Tarsus is that Jesus had risen and encountered him there on the Damascus Road. Or then again, and perhaps most compellingly of all, how do you explain the Christian martyrdoms in the early church? The fact that these men, these apostles, were willing to lay down their lives for their faith. Now, if they were making the whole thing up of the resurrection, they might have gone along with it right up until that point when they're about to be executed. But they wouldn't have carried on with it then, would they? When they're about to be crucified in Peter's case, or about to be beheaded, or whatever means of execution it was, they would have said, hang on a minute, I was only making it up. And no, Jesus isn't really Lord. And they'd have pulled back, wouldn't they, in the face of death. If they knew that the resurrection hadn't really happened, if it had all been a big hoax, if it had all been a big farce, at that point, when faced with death, they would have pulled back. You don't die for something you know isn't true. But the fact that they were willing to die rather than deny the resurrection of Jesus Christ seems rather compelling evidence that they were eyewitnesses who had seen and knew beyond all possible doubt that Jesus was indeed risen from the dead. Well, we've seen then three areas, the Bible, the Gospels, and the resurrection. And as I say, there are only three areas of many, and I've only mentioned tiny little aspects of those three areas, and there's so much more that could be said. Perhaps I will mention just one more thing as we close. And it's the whole character, I suppose, of Christian religion. What is at the heart of Christianity? What is the driving impulse? What is the foundational theme of Christianity? Is it not salvation by grace? Salvation by grace is at the heart of Christianity. And I suppose, again, that in itself isn't remarkable. But it's the sheer relentlessness of it, the sheer consistency of it, which is remarkable. Because, you see, you take Judaism, for instance. Sinclair Ferguson talks about Judaism both in the first century and Orthodox Judaism still today, and the way in which if you ask them, well, how are you saved and what is at the heart of your religion, they'll say salvation by grace. Grace is at the heart of our religion. But as Sinclair Ferguson puts it, when you ask them then to spell grace, they spell it W-O-R-K-S, works. In other words, when you look into it, it's not grace at all. It's at an official level, it's grace. It's salvation by grace. But when you actually look into it, when you look into the nitty-gritty and the details, it's not grace at all. And I can understand that, because I know myself that this is a constant battle in my own heart to maintain that emphasis upon salvation by grace alone. To be able to go to bed at night and base my sense of acceptance with God entirely upon what he has done through Jesus Christ at the cross. That's hard to do, isn't it, consistently? Instinctively, we go to bed at night and we base our sense of acceptance with God on how we've lived that day. If we've had a good day, then we feel very close to God. If we've had a bad day, then the anxieties creep in. And it's very hard to be consistent. It's a battle we always face because instinctively we go back to works, to self, to me contributing somewhere along the line at least to my salvation. And what's remarkable therefore about biblical Christianity, about the Bible, is that from beginning to end, it's always grace. It's always salvation by grace. And never does that self-generated salvation creep in, even in a slight way, even in a subtle way. Again, if this was a human composition, if this book was simply written by human beings, and that was it, end of story, human beings with all those instincts which you have and which I have to save ourselves, it would creep in somewhere, wouldn't it? There would be points where you say, ah, well, unfortunately, there in Jeremiah, we have salvation by works. Most of the Bible, salvation by grace, but Jeremiah, and there's a little bit of Ephesians as well, and it's salvation by works there, unfortunately, because it crept in. But it never does. You go back to the depths of the Old Testament. I was reading the other day in Numbers, and it's Numbers 21, I think, the bronze serpent. And it's an astonishing tale, isn't it? The way in which you have Israel ungrateful and murmuring against God, so God punishes Israel with all these venomous snakes. And then you remember Moses pleads with God, and what's the answer? To go and mount this bronze serpent on a pole. And what do the Israelites have to do? They have to look at the serpent. Now, can you imagine Moses, them watching Moses going and erecting this thing and attaching the bronze serpent to the pole, and the Israelites saying, well, Moses, what do we have to do? How do we get healed from these snake bites? What must we do? And Moses says, just look. Just look. We can't just have to look. We must have to do something. Moses says, no, just look. Just appropriate to yourself by looking that thing up there. And it's salvation by grace, isn't it? Right back there, even in Numbers. Or you go to the giving of the law, the giving of the Ten Commandments, and you thought that if anywhere salvation by something other than grace might creep in, it would be there, where God is given these commandments, thou shalt, thou shalt, thou shalt not. And yet, even there, it's so carefully framed, isn't it? Remember God beginning the Ten Commandments, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of slavery in Egypt. You shall have no other gods before me. In other words, even the law, it's never to be done, never to be done to gain his salvation. It's to be done in the light of a prior salvation. I have done this for you. Do this simply as your expression of gratitude to me. And then you go to the New Testament, and you go to the Apostle Paul, and that astonishing passage in Ephesians 2, where he talks about salvation being by grace. And he even goes as far as to say, doesn't he, that the very faith by which we receive the salvation, even that empty hand that we stretch out, which is all we have to do, that empty hand that we stretch out to receive God's salvation, even that is a gift of God, he says. And you see then the sheer extent, the sheer depth of grace here. There's just no room left anywhere from Genesis to Revelation. No room in any point of our salvation. No room left for our contribution. It's all him doing it. It's 100% him. Even our pathetic little response of faith is from him. And that seems to me unique, and it seems to me supernatural. Because as I say, if I were writing the Bible, or if I'd been given the role of writing just one chapter of the Bible, I reckon that somewhere you'd have found a slight hint or suspicion of salvation by works. But you don't get it. It's just grace all the way. And it's the unique feature of the Christian religion. And it seems to me that that very character and essence then of Christianity again points to its authenticity. Christianity is true. And we need to be persuaded of that for our own sakes, that we'll keep on living energetic Christian lives. For our evangelism, we need to be persuaded of it. And not least, as we come tonight to a prayer meeting, we need to be persuaded of it. For surely the influences of an atheistic culture around us are nowhere more evident than when we lose our appetite to pray. It's influencing us then. We're being tainted and stained by the atheism around us when we lose our appetite to pray, because there's nothing that's more theistic, nothing that's more expressive of faith in a sovereign God than prayer. And it's for that purpose that we are here tonight. Amen.